I'd like to welcome everyone to our Wednesday evening Bible study. We are studying from the book of Job this quarter. Dennis will be back next week. Let's have an opening prayer before we begin. In tonight's class, we are in the second part of the second, we're in the second half of the second group of speeches. Last week we looked at Eliphaz and his second speech and Job's response that took two chapters. Now we're going to be looking at chapter 18 where Bildad begins his second speech. Chapter 19, Job will respond to Bildad's words. And then in chapter 20, Zophar, the third person in this group of friends, also will speak. And then in chapter 21, Job will reply. So we're going to do four chapters tonight. Hopefully we can get through all of them, and Dennis can start on chapter 22 beginning next week. Something to keep in mind as we go throughout this evening, beginning with Bildad and his speech, kind of the thought pattern of Bildad and then the thought pattern of Job. Bildad says, give up the premise that you are innocent. He said, the wicked are doomed, and that you are among those who do not know God. And he's basically saying, you're wicked. Look at what's happening to you. And Job, on the other hand, replies, it's God that has messed up my life. I'm not sure why this is happening. I'm not the one that did this. And my expectation is that a defender will arise and vindicate me from your insinuations. So keep that in the back of your mind as we go through chapters 18 and 19. Chapter 19, chapter 18, begin at verse 1. Then Bildad the Shunite answered and said, how long till you put an end to words? Gain understanding, and afterwards we will speak. Why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself in anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or shall the rock be removed from its place? The light of the wicked indeed goes out, and the flames of the fire, and the flame of his fire does not shine. The light is dark in his tent, and his lamp beside him is put out. The steps of his strength are shortened, and his own counsel cast him down. For he is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walks into a snare. The nets take him by the heel, and the snare lays hold of him. Bildad basically is saying this calamity that you are suffering right now is your own, is of your own making. Bildad is not very nice to Job. If you remember from his first speech, he had been unkind even in his first speech to Job. And in his line of thinking has not changed from his first. And he continues here because of the comments by Job to not only his speech, but speech of the others in this group. He continues to throw darts at Job rather than try to comfort him in some way. Bildad's bottom line is that the wicked always suffer. Therefore, you must be wicked because you're suffering. And in his way of thinking, the evidence is right here. You're suffering, the wicked suffer, you're suffering, therefore you must be wicked. And that's not a reasonable argument. He criticizes Job for not listening to his three friends. And he accuses Job of being closed-minded and arrogant. He seems to feel insulted that Job seems to consider these three friends of his as stupid, even though they are considered wise by their by their peers. Back in chapter 16 and verse 9, Job claims that God had torn him apart. Here, Bildad argues that it was Job and not God who had torn himself because of Job's uncontrolled anger. As you continue to read, Bildad presents a list of references designed to lead one to conclude that the wicked always suffer. Job never denies that the wicked suffer, but they don't always suffer immediately, which is absolutely true. I mean, we could probably think of a lot of people who did bad things, and they seemed to prosper for a long time, and either they went to the grave without being punished in this life, or it was a very long time before things caught up with them. And so here we see that Bildad's argument is that they all always suffer. Job counters with, well, that's true, but they don't always suffer immediately. Bildad accuses Job of not listening, but in fact it is Bildad who has made no attempt to understand Job's arguments. Of note is that in both of his speeches, Bildad presumes to speak for God in his accusations against Job. And Bildad's conclusion, as we saw before, is give up the pretense. The wicked are doomed, and you are among those who do not know God. And so he is basically condemning Job rather than coming. He came there to comfort him, and he is actually condemning Job because he said, basically, Job, you're wicked. You need to go ahead and confess, and everything will be okay, and you'll get through this. And Job is maintaining his innocence, and Bildad is very frustrated that he continues to maintain this innocence that in Bildad's viewpoint is not correct. There's something that Job has done that deserves this punishment. Let's move on to chapter 19. Yeah. Then it says that Bildad is ignoring creation. And if you look at, I believe it's in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says that God causes it to rain on the just and the unjust. No matter whether you're wicked or not wicked, you do receive some blessing. If a wicked man and a righteous man both plant in the ground, they're both going to get a crop. And so what Bildad is saying isn't actually accurate at all. And he isn't looking toward at creation and drawing the correct conclusion. Yeah. He said he calls Bildad a fair weather friend, one who comes, thinks he has all the answers, and if you don't listen to those answers they give, they turn on you. We do see that happen quite often. A lot of, again, 21st century principles that we see today in man, even though we're much further along, we haven't progressed that much. We're still the same old people that we had back in those days. They couldn't get themselves out of this box that they had put themselves in, that they came to the conclusion that if you're suffering, then God's punishing you for some reason. Again, that kind of reasoning was back in the first century as well. When Jesus came upon that man who was, I think it was a man who was lame from birth, and he said, is this man sinned or his parents? That thinking was still around many years later. Starting in chapter 19, Then Job answered and said, how long will you torment my soul and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have reproached me. You are not ashamed that you have wronged me. And indeed, if I have erred, my error remains with me. If indeed you exalt yourselves against me and plead my disgrace against me, know that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net. Here Job again lets his friends know that he is not very happy with these hurtful words that they are using against him. They've crushed him with words. They've insulted him. They fail to substantiate any of the wrongdoings that they claim that Job has done. And Job says, you've insulted me 10 times. Probably not this is more of an example using the number 10 rather than the number. He wasn't sitting there counting how many times they'd done. He's trying to say, look, you've done all these things, and he just puts that number out there because 10 was a number, one of those complete numbers that they used back in those days. And he says, you just continue, you keep going at it and punish me with your words. And then he says, if what you're saying is true, that God is punishing me for sin, if that is true, then God has wronged me because I haven't done anything. But Job doesn't believe that. He believes that there's got to be another reason that this is happening to him. In verses 7 through 12, as you continue to read, Job again says that he wants to talk to God. He is frustrated that God is seemingly not listening to him or is not concerned about his condition. He has not lost his faith in God, but he desperately wants to reestablish communication with God and find out why this is happening to him and what he can do to change this. And then in verses 13 through 20, Job describes his plight. He says, my friends won't listen. My family has abandoned me. Even my servants ignore me. My former friends are now my enemies. And he says, I'm just barely hanging on. And then down in Job 19, verses 21 and 22, he says, have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you my friends. For the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? Here Job appeals for their compassion. One would think that seeing someone in such a pitiful condition would merit some reaction that would cause them to have compassion on him. Yet not with Job. Job's hope and dignity are gone, and he is greatly discouraged at this point. It seems that Job's family and his friends have some flawed thinking in regards to their understanding of God. Perhaps they had the idea that if God is, and this goes along with this retribution principle that Job's friends had as well, is that if God is always punishing the wicked and blessing the righteous, then treating someone who is suffering because they think that this person is wicked, that this person is being punished by God. And if I go and help that person or be nice to that person or have compassion on that person, God may also decide to punish me because rather than helping this person, I'm actually going against what God is intending for this person to he's trying to punish this person to bring them back into a right relationship, I guess is what they're thinking. And the last thing they want to do is find themselves in a position of fighting against God. Imagine how different the parable in Luke chapter 10, or the lesson we can learn from the Good Samaritan. We're not sure if this is a parable or if this is actually something that actually happened. And it could be very well something that actually did happen. And we know that in the story that Jesus tells, this person was traveling. They were set on by thieves. They were robbed. They were stripped of everything they had. And they were beaten, basically left for dead. A priest comes by, goes on the other side of the road to get away from him. A Levite comes by and also decides to pass him by. But a Samaritan comes, sees him. He patches him up, puts him on his own animal, takes him in, gives him a place to stay while he's healing, talks to the person running this hotel that here's some money. If this person needs any more, when I come back, I'll pay you the rest. And this is a person who looked out. He had compassion on this person in their distress. Imagine how that would have sounded like with this kind of, or what this person's actions would have been if they thought like these people were thinking in Job. Might go something like this. A traveler's robbed, he's beaten by thieves, and he's left for dead on the road. He's passed up by a priest and a Levite. A Samaritan man sees a person lying in the road, likely unconscious, bleeding, obviously needing medical condition or medical attention. He reasons with himself. This person is suffering, so he is obviously being punished by God. I could help him, but if I do, I may be going against God. The best thing I can do for this man is to leave him where he is until God is finished with his punishment. Maybe I can actually help out God by going and kicking this guy a few times before I move on. That's kind of what was happening. I mean, it sounds comical, but that's kind of what these people were doing to Job. They saw him in a bad situation, not willing to help him at all. In fact, making life harder for him. That's not what Jesus taught us in the first century about what we are to do. Completely opposite. Yeah, the law was, yes, before the law actually came out. Again, this may be why Job's family and friends and everyone he knew were so hard on him. And their misguided understanding of God and the way he interacts with man, they inflicted even more pain and heartache on Job. After all that he has suffered up to this point, up to verse 22, listen to what he says next. In verse 25 through 27. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I will see God, whom I shall see for myself. My eyes shall behold and not another. How my heart yearns within me. These three verses have been the source of a lot of debate by scholars as to exactly what Job means here. Is this a prophecy about Jesus returning? Is it a prophecy of somehow if he's going to see God in the flesh? We don't know. It is clear that Job is confident that he serves the living God, who will vindicate and defend him, and who will redeem him from his current distress. Job placed confidence in this Redeemer, this Goel, which is a Hebrew word, and that he will be vindicated while he is still living. And as we know, that's exactly what happens. Job also expresses his belief in the afterlife, that he will see God after his flesh is gone. Yeah, if you remember that slide I showed you last week, where this literary kind of the way the story plays out, chapter 19, verses 25 through 27 really are the turning point, or the, you might call it a climax if it was a novel. It's the turning point of the book. It's at the very top of that pyramid. And from here, the conflict, although it's not completely gone, begins to become resolved. And there's some resolution as we go down toward the conclusion of this story. I want to take a small departure here and talk about this term, Goel. The Old Testament principles of the Christian Goel, or Redeemer, was important to the Israelites, but it carries even more significance to Christians in the New Testament. Goel, or Redeemer, means vindicator, one who proves you innocent, an advocate, one who speaks on your behalf, or a near kinsman. Now, near kinsman, I apologize for this being so small. A near kinsman had four duties in the Old Testament. It was to exact vengeance in a blood feud. That's found in Deuteronomy. He was to redeem the kinsman from slavery. He was to redeem family property. And he was also to marry the widow, so that a person's family name could carry on. Think about those things from the Old Testament, of the near kinsman, as it applies to Jesus and his role as the near kinsman during his ministry on earth. Jesus was to redeem Israel. He gave himself to redeem us from our sins. Jesus redeemed us from an ungodly lifestyle in 1 Peter 1:18. And eternal redemption comes from the blood of Christ. Think about what this term of the near kinsman is, as it applies to that role that Jesus played while he was here. And if you think about a near kinsman, Jesus is what? What's Jesus' relationship to us? He's like an older brother. He's a near kinsman to Christians. Okay. And the near kinsman was supposed to be the person who was in a family, the closest person, blood relative of the person who was either enslaved or their property had been taken, been sold, or they need to get that property back, or other things. It was the duty of that near kinsman, the closest family relative, to do that. So when think about that as Jesus as well. Job firmly believed that his Redeemer lives and will stand on this earth. Jesus, our Redeemer, stood on this earth as a man. He died for our sins. He was raised from the grave by God on the third day. And like Job, we have confidence today that our Redeemer lives. And as Dennis pointed out earlier when he talks about seeing that Redeemer or seeing God. He points us over to 42:6, right? 42:5, yeah. That's what happens later on in our study. Chapter 20 records the second final contribution that Zophar makes in this book of Job. He does not participate in the third round of speeches. Zophar, probably the younger of these three men, because he's the one that goes last. His position is that your sin is pride, and God has judged you as wicked. And Job, in his reply to Zophar's remarks, is the system, meaning God's policies, the system is broken. And he is not sure exactly, again, what's going on, not sure, what he is saying is that this is broken. I've never seen this happen before. Yeah. And Dennis points out that the system he's talking about is the retribution principle. If he was, then it would, in Job's reasoning, if I'm a righteous person, there's no reason for God to be punishing me, for this. And so there's something wrong with this way. He's thinking there's got to be something else. Not sure exactly what that might be. I know God is not very happy with them when he makes that known to them near the end of the book. He speaks to them and lets them understand the flaws in their thinking. But we really don't know after what happens afterwards with these men. Yeah. 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 We have no information that I know of of what happened to these men later on. What he's saying, be careful about casting stones because, you're not in a position to do that. What God does, not you. And I think he is giving them some warning about, be careful about saying someone else is sinful when you may have some things against you that other people don't know. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting that we know a lot about what happens later. We don't know everything that happens later. It would be nice to know if what happened to these three men after all this occurred. Did they learn anything? Especially after God spoke to them and talked, had a word with them. So here's Zophar. Begins his speech in chapter 20. And he is sitting there and he's listening to all these things that are going on. It says, then Zophar, the Naamathite, answered and said, therefore my anxious thoughts make me answer, because of turmoil within me. I have heard the rebuke that reproaches me, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer. Do you not know this of old, since man was placed on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? Though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens, and his head reaches to the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own refuse. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? Zophar considers Job's words to be insulting and degrading to his to him and his friends. And any thought that Zophar might have had about remaining silent and just letting this go on, was, he thought about it. He went by it. It's one of these things where somebody says, I gotta speak. I can't let this go by. He sees this as Job's blatant refusal to see the truth. And Zophar's wisdom, as he calls it, requires him to respond. And he makes the same argument that Bildad made, that Job needs to go back to the age-old, timeless truths. Again, the retribution theory. He needs to look back at these age-old, timeless truths. And he says, you've forgotten these things. You need to go back and take a look at them. Yet Zophar is convinced that these points are universally and unalterably true, which is the flaw in his thinking. He says, the wicked man may prosper, but it is only briefly. God delays punishment to teach a wicked man a lesson, but God will eventually deal justly with the wicked. Zophar is still not being honest with the observable facts of life. And certainly all of them have seen evil men who have prospered until they died, which is, so how can Zophar account for such men as that? Unfortunately, he and the other three friends do not consider this a serious argument. So Job continues in chapter 20, verses 27 through 29. The heavens will reveal your iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart, and the goods will flow away in the day of his wrath. This is the portion from God for a wicked man, the heritage to him appointed by God. Zophar says, if you ask for heavens and earth to bear witness of your innocence, but they, according to Zophar, could be a witness against you. Zophar says that eventually the wicked will lose all that they've accumulated. And since Job has lost all he has accumulated, he must be a wicked man. He says that God allowed Job to prosper, but only for a while. His speech shows a lack of compassion for sinners and demonstrates no belief or hope that the wicked might repent and turn back to God. His blessing, like Bildad, Zophar has merciless judgment. And in chapter 42, it's going to kindle God's wrath. Job answers in chapter 21, 1 through 6, and it says, and Job answered and said, listen carefully to my speech and let your consolation bear with me that I may speak. And after I have spoken, keep mocking. As for me, is my complaint against man? And if I were, why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished. Put your hands over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am terrified, and trembling takes hold of my flesh. Job here is inviting them to listen carefully to his speech. He doesn't believe they've seriously considered his arguments, which they haven't. And Job begins his speech in a somewhat unusual way. Tells their friends that you need to be careful and listen because you haven't listened up to this point. And afterwards, go ahead and mock me if you want, but you're going to listen to what I have to say. He's tired of their games, and he's ready already to know that they're not going to listen to him, even though he's got to speak to them. And we've only got about another 2 minutes, but I'm going to try to get through the last bit here. He says, why do the wicked live, beginning in verse 7, why do the wicked live and become old? yet some mighty in power. Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes, and their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God upon him. Their bulls breed without failure, and their cows calve without miscarriage. And they send forth their little ones like a flock, and their children dance. And they sing to the tambourine and harp and rejoice to the sound of the flute. They spend their days in wealth, and their moments go down, and in the moment they go down to the grave. Yet they say to God, "Depart from us, for we do not desire the knowledge of your ways." I'm going to stop right there. Job here is saying, look around you. There are plenty of people who are bad people that have prospered. You talk about the wicked person always suffers. Not all of them. There's quite a few. And just look around you and you'll see it. And down in verse 22 through 34, he says, "Can anyone teach God knowledge? Since he judges those on high, one dies in his full strength, being holy and at ease and secure. His pails are full of milk, and the marrow of his bones is moist. Another man dies in the bitterness of his soul, never having eaten with pleasure. They lie down like the dust, and worms cover them. Look, I know your thoughts and the schemes with which you would wrong me. For you say, where is the house of the princes, and where is the tent of the dwelling places of the wicked? Have you not asked those who travel the road and do not know their signs?" He's basically saying, look around. Surely you've heard around from people who come and go, these merchants. There's plenty of people, and you're ignoring the obvious fact that there are bad people who never are punished in this earth. That kind of, we're running out of time again. So Dennis will pick up in chapter 22 next week. Thank you so much for your attendance.